session number 31044, reel 2.
Had two Sundays with them in the Michaelisburg Mountains, which is northeast of Joburg. Very enjoyable. I got very friendly with a couple of brothers, German Jews, called Hans and Emil Richter, who had, as Hans said, they had escaped from Germany just before hostilities started. We were born on the German-Swiss border, 200 yards on the wrong side. But Hans was a superb rock climber. And in the Michaelisburg Mountains, you didn't climb mountains. You climbed what's known as kloofs, great ravines. I may have a photograph of a kloof in here. That's a Himalaya. Now that's in the Michaelisburg Mountains. There's Emil Richter. And that's Hans. He was a superb rock climber.
What sort of grade of climbs are you talking about here?
Sorry?
What sort of grading of climbing was this?
Sort of?
Grading. The level of difficulty of the...
Oh, the level, yes. We did one or two severes, led by Hans, because wait a minute. That's Hans again. There was one called the Coffin, which was a severe, and I've got a picture of it. Ah, there we are. This is the kind of climbing in the cliffs. So that was quite a happy time. And on top of that, the weekends that I wasn't away with the Michaelisburg, with the Transvaal Mountaineering Club, we got marvellous hospitality in Joburg. The Jewish Institute, for a start, was a great place to go. They would put you up and feed you. And they would also arrange for you to go out and have hospitality of a family for the weekend. And a friend of mine and myself, we went out, and we were assigned to go to a mansion just in the outskirts of Joburg, which belonged to a Mr. Finlay, who turned out to be Scots. And he was a South African minister at the time. I think he was controller of Ireland Steel or something like that. Yeah. So we had the great hospitality and food, the likes of which I had never tasted before, you know, like doves and this kind of thing. So that was quite a happy time.
How did you find the general South African reaction to the...
I'm coming to that because... In Joburg, not too bad. In Pretoria, very bad. At that time, the South African actually had a Nazi party in South Africa called the Bund. And there was all sorts of subversion going on because there was the fact that we had, during the Boer War, instituted these concentration camps for Boers and their families still rankled, but in a way you can't blame them about, you know. But in Pretoria, it was not comfortable. You couldn't go out and in the streets on your own or anything like that. And I'll come to that in a minute, but because after the camp at Littleton, we were then assigned to an elementary flying training school. And the one I went to was in Kroonstadt, in the Orange Free State, which was very much a hotbed of the Boer movement. So we were instructed to stay in our in camp as much as possible. Don't go. Certainly never go out on your own. Well, I was assigned to an instructor called Lieutenant Franklin. South African instructors had army ranks, who was a bit older than the average, probably be about 35, you know, an old man, ancient, yes, but nice man and very quiet. And our very first trip, he showed me around the aircraft. It was a Tiger Moth, a DH-82, and showed me the controls, told me what we were going to do, took off, climbed to about 1,500 feet, and the engine stopped. I said, oh. He said, normally what we would do in a case like this is dive to see if we can start the engine again. He said, but we're not high enough, so we're going to have to force land. Tiger Moth glides fairly well. Yeah. So he said, a bit early in your instruction, Marshal, but he said, forced landings. He says, what you do is you select a field where you can actually land into the wind, if you know where the wind is. Yes. Yes, sir. What you must never do is, having selected a field, is change your mind. You haven't got the height for it. So halfway down, he changed his mind. He selected a field, first of all. Halfway down, he changed his mind. And we finally got into a field that was far too short. There's no brakes on a Tiger Moth. So we careered across the field, through a hedge, across a road, into a ditch, and finished with the tail up in the air. He's in the front seat and I'm in the back seat. And he'd forgotten to switch off the ignition. So I think he did everything wrong. Come to think of it now, and there was petrol dripping. The tanks between the two top wings, and there was petrol dripping from the tanks. And in no time at all, we were surrounded by farmers with Land Rovers and horses and carts and goodness knows what. And one enterprising bloke that brought a tin to catch the petrol coming out of So that was my first flight. Well, we got word back to the airfield by one of the farmers, and a low loader came out and picked up the airplane. And on examination, it was sand in the petrol. It was sabotage. Because the South Africans, the ones that were really against the British, a lot of them had joined the forces. You could join the South African forces at that time and elect to serve only in South Africa. And if you did that, you got a red flash on the epaulette, see it like this. So a lot of these were actual subversives, and they would sabotage anything they could, and they sabotaged my first flight. I forbore to ask Mr. Franklin, do you always land like this? But there we are. I got through the elementary flying training quite reasonably.
Would you be able to explain a bit more about the processes involved in teaching someone to fly who'd never been in the plane before?
You start off with what's known as air experience. Here we are. I've got my logbook here. Lieutenant Franklin, that's the man I was telling you about. Air experience. Familiarity with cockpit layout, effective controls, taxiing and handling of engines, straight and level flight, so forth, so forth, so forth. It's all elementary stuff to start with. And it depends on how good you are, whether they continue with your flying training or not. Eric, my friend in the aircrew receiving centres, you know, looked to me to be the absolute epitome of what a pilot should look like, you know, a real hero. I found that he couldn't land an aircraft, he didn't know where the ground was. And after he wrote off two undercarriages, he was washed out and sent for training as a navigator. It shows you, you can never go by appearances. Some people that you think would make wonderful pilots didn't. Others that looked rather wimpish did. So there you go. I think it took me 10 hours for solo pilot. Ah, here we are, first solo. 8 hours, 35. About 9 hours before I went solo. And I was quite proud because I was the first to go solo in the whole shebang. Not that I was anything great as a pilot at all, I never was, but just one of these things. Probably I got on quite well with Lieutenant Franklin. You know, he's a nice man. And we had a kind of bond between us after finishing in a ditch. But it was up to him to send me to the flight Lieutenant Purdy, who was the chief flying instructor, to decide whether I could go solo or not. Oh, what was it Mr. Purdy sent to me? That's interesting. Oh, yes. After a few flights with Lieutenant Franklin, he put me up for a test with Flight Lieutenant Purdy, the chief flying instructor. After landing, he undid his harness and said, "I'm getting out now, Marshal, and I hope for your sake JC steps in. Now go and do a circuit and bump." So JC must have stepped in, because I'm still here. That was elementary flying training school.
What was the Tiger Moth like to fly?
Sorry?
What was the Tiger Moth like to fly?
Oh, a lovely little aeroplane. Really nice to fly. It's one of these, aerodynamically, it was very good indeed. For instance, one of the exercises that you did was spinning. Now, in order to spin an aircraft, you first of all, you let it stall, throttle back, let it stall, and then put on full rudder one way or the other, and it flips over and starts spinning like this. Now, to get out of a spin in any other aircraft than the Tiger Moth was rather difficult. The Tiger Moth, if you just took your hands and feet off everything, it would come out itself. You know, it was so well adjusted aerodynamically. And actually, after the war, and I'd been a civilian for a couple of years, I got rather nostalgic for flying, and I joined the reserve again, back to Tiger Moth, but then chipmunks after that. Yes.
What was the layout of the cockpit in the
time? Sorry,
the cockpit layout.
The cockpit layout. Oh my God! Very simple in a Tiger Moth. You have the usual Sperry panel that includes the artificial horizon, and the altimeter, airspeed indicator. I would have to see it again, really. There's the throttle on your left. Rudders, of course. No clutch and no brakes. Very, very simple indeed, yes, as Tiger was. But that's the whole beauty of the thing. Is that for somebody starting to fly, I would say that the Tiger Moth hasn't been surpassed, really, as an elementary flying. In America, they have the Stearman, which is a kind of bigger version of the Tiger Moth, but still a single-engine biplane. And the Stearman is the one that's still used for these wing-walking displays that you get from place to place. That's a Stearman that they use for that. Yeah. Okay.
Where next after the elementary training?
After elementary training. Then we went on to service flying training. Now, I have to consult my notes from time to time. In September, that's 42, I was posted to service flying training school at Waterkloof, again near Pretoria, and found that the aircraft we would be flying were Hawker Harts, which had been first line fighter bombers between the wars. I believe they were used operationally on the northwest frontier of India. The Hart was a two-seater biplane adapted for dual control, and the first part of the course was devoted to learning to handle it. My instructor was a tiny flying officer called Parker, known as Titch for obvious reasons. In the Hart, the pupil sat in the front cockpit. This meant if you were only 5'3", as Titch was, there was no way you could see ahead. When Titch was landing, he had to look out the side. He was just a little travish. The only way he could land was get some idea of where the ground was, looking out the side. He couldn't see a thing ahead. It was just tiny. When Titch was landing, he had to look out the side to see where the ground was. And when it came to low flying, it was positively alarming. He would instruct me to call out if any obstacle loomed in front so that he could leapfrog it. So there I was, white-knuckled in the front cockpit, shouting things like, "Big tree! Haystack! Church steeple!" I don't think I was any more frightened when later in the war Japs were shooting at me. Titch was a supremely fizzy and likeable little man, and I hope he survived the war. With his low flying, I wonder. He was really amazing. I got on very well with him.
How did you find the Harts to fly?
They were difficult. Difficult to land. They had very narrow undercarriages. And at the point of stall, you know, where you're actually landing, they were inclined to drop a wing. So it was a bit like stirring porridge, you know, trying to keep the wings level like this. And they were quite difficult to land. But in some ways, they were a very good aircraft. They're a Rolls-Royce Kestrel engine, was it, or Pegasus? Hawker Harts. Rolls-Royce Kestrel engine, which in an aircraft that's just built of flimsy materials, that gave it a terrific climbing rate. You know, you could go up, as the saying was, like a fart in a bat. Straight up. Far greater climbing rate than the American Harvard, which was also the advanced trainer. So when we were considered proficient enough on hearts, we moved on to Hocker Hinds, which were in full operational mode. The rear cockpit fitted with bomb sight. The bomb sight was actually underneath the pilot's seat. If the bomb aimer from the rear cockpit wanted to get on the bomb sight, he had to instruct the pilot to put the seat up. The seats were so he could crawl underneath and get at the bomb sight. And it had a scaffolding with a machine gun on it at the back. Theo 3 Vickers. And a monkey chain. The observer in the back seat had a chain attached to his parachute harness and the floor, the other end of the floor. So he couldn't actually fall out. But if the pilot was not getting on with his navigator, he would do a slow roll and watch him hanging from the monkey chain.
Again, what were the Hinds like to fly? How were the Hinds to fly?
The Hinds, the same as the Harts. It was the same aircraft, really, just slight modifications to it. Now, what happened there? I was teamed with another pupil pilot, Johnny Marks, and for the next 3 or so months we took turns in front and back cockpits and took part in many of the aspects of operational flying. Bombing, high and low level, gunnery, air-to-air and air-to-ground, camera and live ammunition, navigation, instrument flying, night flying, formation flying, low flying, forced and precautionary landings, aerobatics and more. It was an intensive course and we learned a great deal. The course culminated on the 23rd of February 1943 on what was probably the proudest day of my life until then. My wings were presented to me by Major General Everard Poole, Commander-in-Chief of the South African Forces. Wings Day was a big event in Waterkloof, as a fair sprinkling of South African trainee pilots were involved and all their families were there. There were also an exhibition of marching, counter-marching and arms drill by a unit of the South African Army. A fly past by 3 Hawker Harts and a drum and fife band. All this was organised and controlled by Captain Chater, a tall, mild-mannered flight commander. Unfortunately, Captain Chater's soft voice was not equal to the competition offered by the band and the low-flying aircraft. His orders to the marching unit were completely inaudible and resulted in what could best be described as a shambles. Still, the occasion was a happy one, and in the celebrations which followed, the foul-up was soon forgotten. I can still see him now, Captain Chater. Nothing coming out, and the drum and fife band belt were... would you like a cup of coffee?
What sort of aerobatics had been involved in that?
Well, we did the usual aerobatics there. Loops, slow rolls, barrel rolls, stall turns. That's about the usual. I was never very good at a slow roll. A slow roll, you're hanging out. A barrel roll's different. You're held in by gravity. But once you're on your back like that, the controls are reversed. I was never very good at that, but then again, on bombers, you never use it anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Were you at this stage aware of what branch of the RAF you were being?
No. At that point, just did the service training. And from there on in, you were actually allotted to either bombers or fighters. And the big need was for bomber pilots, of course, because the 44% attrition rate in bomber pilots was terrible, you know. You know, there were more aircrew lost in one raid on Nuremberg than in the whole of the Battle of Britain. One raid. Amazing.
Was this something that was in your mind as you were going?
No, no, not at that time, no. Far too irresponsible.
How did the instruments only flying training?
Sorry?
How were you trained on instrument only flying? The instruments only.
Oh, instrument flying. I was quite good at instrument flying. And I was very good at night flying for some reason or other. I found that I could land an aircraft at night better than I could in, during the day. In fact, on one notable occasion at OTU, my wireless operator had been struggling to get permission to land at Harwell. And in the meantime, I'd got a green light from the control tower to land. So I went in and landed. And as we were taxiing along, my wireless operator pipped up and said, "Skipper, I've got permission to land." I said, "Joe, we're down." He said, "My God, that must have been some landing."
How much aware were you of what was happening elsewhere in the war during your time in South Africa?
Oh, well, we were aware. I mean, we did have lectures from various officers that kept us in touch with more or less what was going on. So, in a kind of vague way, we were aware.
What happened then once you'd got your wings?
Well, the thing that sticks in my mind was we got 3 weeks' leave. And six of us booked up in the Cathedral Peak Hotel in the Drakensberg. And we had a marvellous 3 weeks climbing in the Drakensberg. It was really terrific fun. Apart from the fact that the Drakensbergs are kind of full of baboons, and they love to get above you and chuck rocks at you. You know? But we were warned about them, and you know, and they would chatter away and chuck rocks down. And also we came across a snake that looked rather unfamiliar, and one of the boys dropped a rock on it. And we took it back to the hotel, and it turned out to be a mamba. There are two types of mamba, green and black. Ah.
Which type was it?
The Drakensberg's beautiful mountains.
Which type of mamba did it turn out to be?
Sorry?
Which type of mamba?
As far as I remember, it was a green mamba. But the hotel keeper knew anyway, and he took a very dim view of it. That's the hotel. My one equestrian. That's me. That was a Cathedral Peak. Glad I kept all these pictures because there's a lot of nostalgia in them.